Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, my next guest is Sloane Crossley, who crossed the divide between publicist and publicized by writing a book of essays on life and disappointment in New York. It's called I Was Told There'd Be Cake. Sloane Crossley, welcome to WNYC.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And maybe you've seen her essays published in various New York media. You've said that these are essays on disappointment, so let's get right into that theme. You're going to read a passage from your essay called The Ursula Cookie. And to set it up, I'll say that it takes place after your boss, the title character, Ursula, has reduced you to tears. Do you want to set it up in any other way or just read?
Oh, tears is satisfactory. I think that's embarrassing enough.
Then I'm all ears.
Okay. Around this time, my precious work ethic began to atrophy in earnest, and truth be told, it has never returned. A basic affinity for office work may appear expendable to most, but I was a good girl from the suburbs, where self-worth was color-coded and bound and crazy-glued into a diorama. Yet when the phone would ring in Ursula's office, I'd run to the bathroom to avoid picking it up. As a break, I'd indulge myself by locking the main door to the ladies' room, sitting on the radiator, and breathing. I was, in fact, in that very spot when it dawned on me that Sarah, Ursula's old assistant, had opted to spend the rest of her life in America's most violent prisons rather than work another day for Ursula. Ursula once said to me, almost as a point of fascination, "You sit out there all day and I have no idea what you're doing." I wish I could have answered her. Email had not yet made its way into the new office computers, nor had the internet. Mostly I was staring at the plastic bumps on my coffee lid, blurring my vision to make them turn from cream, black, and decaf to laid off, demoted, and fired.
So wait, what was your job?
I was an assistant to a literary agent in New York.
So you were her assistant?
Yes, I was assistant in a very small office as well.
And
so
she,
that I didn't have any
and
peers.
She complained that she didn't know what you do when the job of an assistant is to do what the boss tells her to do.
That's true. Although, to her credit, she's a bit of a monster in this essay, but to her credit, by the time that point I just read rolls around, I had become a pretty terrible assistant because, you know, I was so afraid of messing up that the fear just blocked any functionality pores I had. So,
Your essay, You on a Stick, is on the surface a tale of survival in the face of what you refer to as a bride-tatorship, so maybe you should define that word first.
Well, I think it's just a sort of new spin on the whole bridezilla concept. I think what made this specific thing a little bit different, and most of these essays aren't situations that are entirely foreign to anyone, it's just something is a little bit off, and what made this one a little bit off was that I hadn't really spoken to the woman who asked me to be in her wedding for years. So it was a very strange experience.
And you write, high school was the last time I had a formal group of female friends that exceeded, say, three. So what happened to your friendships as you got older? And do you think this is typical of most people?
I think it's typical in a way because you have to start making choices in a way. You know, when you're younger, you don't really have anything to do but make friends. You know, even in college, you're sleeping in, you're hopefully attending a class or two. And then eventually everybody's priorities get pulled in different directions. And I think it's normal that your sort of friend field gets narrowed down a little bit. But I think I had that problem always, really, just to turn this into a psychotherapy session.
By the way, one little detail from that essay. Did Francine and Boris, the couple whose wedding you bridesmaided for, really change their last name to Universe?
Asking the hard-hitting questions. It's actually, it was changed to a different massive body of space.
You changed the name to protect the innocent.
I did. I changed
even the joke names.
Even the joke name. I will assure you that her name was changed to something that was very grand.
So the two of them took this name that represented something very grand.
Yes.
About human life or beyond, something even beyond human life.
The and they entire both big took, world.
They both took that last name.
They did. I think they decided to issue the names they had. They had no real attachment to them. And so they went out forging their own path, as it were.
maybe it's a good idea.
Maybe it is a good idea. Well, you know, I mean, I don't know. We don't all have to be, you know, if your last name isn't, you know, Woolworth or Hornblower or something like that, maybe it's best to think of something new.
Hornblower?
You know, the steam engine hornblowers.
Why do you say this is a book about disappointment?
It's a book about disappointment because I think it's a book about going into most situations, having your expectations be set in a certain way, as I think a lot of people in my generation and my age.
How old are you?
I'm 29.
See, normally I wouldn't just ask somebody, how old are you? But since you said it was a book about people your age, I felt like I had this license.
You did. I just left you open for it. But it's, you know, and so it's about certainly comic disappointment. I think it's actually bad. I should probably stop telling people it's about disappointment. Who wants to read a book of essays about disappointment?
It's a funny book about disappointment.
There you go. Thanks. See, I sort of, you know, trapped you into saying that.
and you got me. So take me further into that. There are particular kinds of disappointment that you think are typical to people around 30?
There are specific kinds. I mean, there's certainly, you know, I don't want to make it sound too bratty because I think that, you know, I was raised to sort of pay my dues, this work essay I just read from, you know, and, you know, to expect sort of a certain kind of, expect certain things and also have to work for certain types of things. But invariably, there seems to be this sort of mishmash of just essentially growing up. I don't know if it's necessarily, I mean, there are certain flags that are indicative to my generation specifically in the essay collection, you know, Oregon Trail or, you know, specific 80s and 90s references. But at the end of the day, it's really sort of the humor of coming of age.
So anybody relate to that? Or anybody who has ever read Sloane Crosley's essays? You've seen her in the New York Times, the New York Observer, Playboy, The Village Voice, Salon, Black Book, among other publications. 212-433-WNYC if you want to talk to Sloane Crosley this morning. 212-433-9692. And one of the points of, I guess I can't say pride, in your press materials here, in your bio, is that you also wrote the cover story for the worst-selling issue of Maxim in that magazine's history. What story was that?
It was The Women of One Tree Hill, which is a show on the CW, and allegedly, and I don't know if I was being told this for comfort purposes, the people at the magazine told me it sold so poorly because there were three women on the cover, and I guess in the overly simplified male gaze, they couldn't quite focus in on any one woman, so three women on a cover, you know, unless it's an Annie Leibovitz shoot for Vanity Fair, doesn't tend to sell very well. But I like to think it was my inability to ask them where they bought their thongs, you know.
So here you are, a woman in your 20s in New York writing for Maxim and Playboy. You okay
yes.
with that? I guess you are because you did it.
I think I am okay with it because largely, and this is an unfortunate situation, but men's magazines tend to allow for more space and more feature articles that are less pointed about beauty and have a sort of a wider variety of topics than women's magazines largely.
Isn't that sad?
Yes, it's very sad. There are exceptions, of course. You know, Vogue has a great section. They have a nostalgia section, and I don't want to go around, you know, now trashing the magazines that have supported the book. But there's less room for it, and there's more room for essays, and usually for women's magazines, it's more reportage kind of stuff.
Now, it's almost, I mean, you're saying people really do buy Playboy for the articles.
I should hope so, because I wrote, you know, I mean, I can walk around saying I was in Playboy, and I hope people certainly know that it was in a textual context.
It was your byline. Has anyone you've written about in your essays recognized themselves? Have you received terse emails from the real-life Ursula or Mr. and Mrs. Universe?
I warned them ahead of time. I actually have not. The only person I haven't warned, because my fear is obviously so deep-seated as it is in the essay, it's very real, of my first boss. So I actually don't think she'll particularly care very much, but that's sort of a gamble. And other people have. Yes, I've warned them ahead of time that, you know, here's an essay that is very, very, very much based on your life.
So put on your headphones, because here, so Alex in the Lincoln Center area claims, is a fellow 29-year-old who wants to make you feel less disappointed. Hi, you're on WNYC.
Hello. I listen to your show all the time, and I just had to call in about this. What I wanted to say was that, yeah, there is a lot of disappointment. When I was 24, I thought I knew exactly where my career was going, my personal life was going, and now I'm 29. It's not even close to what I thought it was going to be. But it turned out pretty well as it is. And I think that you're right, there are a lot of disappointments and a lot of things that you didn't see coming. But by the same token, it's not a bad ride, and it turned out okay. So that's all I had to say, really.
All right. Well, then there's hope. Do you want to engage Alex here
at
all?
Yes, sure. In fact, I think what's funny is that there is that other side to it. I don't mean to imply that these essays don't come out the other end. They're not just sort of, down there in the gutter looking up at the stars. There's hopefully a lot of hope to them as well. And situations, I think what I try to avoid in the essays themselves is situations where you learn a lesson in every essay. I think there are a couple of them. But mostly sometimes if things don't work out, it just sort of reinforces the personality and the life that you're sort of meant to have as opposed to the ones that you thought you were going to have.
Alex, thanks a lot. I think you left him speechless. The story, one of the funny stories that's also about disappointment is about volunteering at the Museum of Natural History, where you worked in the butterfly exhibit. So what made you volunteer there, and how did it end badly?
Well, I felt compelled, and again, maybe to offset the slight brattiness of thinking that your life should be a bit easier than it is, I felt compelled to volunteer after I graduated from college. But I must have known sort of subconsciously that I didn't really want to. And so I decided that, I shouldn't be, volunteering in a soup kitchen or a homeless shelter or shopping for pantsuits or anything of this nature. And I decided to take the easy way out by volunteering at a museum a few blocks north of me. So that's how it started. And then what happened was, I don't know if you're familiar with the exhibit itself, but the museum has a seasonal butterfly exhibit that has not rare, but sort of butterflies from all around the world. And I got freaked out on my last day when I had finally decided to quit. I accidentally brushed against a character called the Atlas Moth, which is a disgusting large moth. If you're not familiar with it, it doesn't translate over radio, but it's really gross. Brushed against it, ran home, only to realize that I had not checked myself in the mirrors of the exhibit, and I had accidentally kidnapped one of the smaller butterflies.
Uh-huh. And somebody found out about that?
Actually, nobody found out about it. I tried to bring, it was a little bit too late because my shift was late. I tried to bring it back to the museum in a sort of colander and a cutting board. A very sophisticated cage, which I crafted, and nobody was there, and I eventually had to set it free.
Thus proving that the road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Or broken little butterfly wings.
Comes from your volunteer. What was that species of moth that you described as gross?
It's called the Atlas Moth. In Southeast Asia, they use their cocoons for handbags, just to give you an idea.
We're not supposed to say that any exotic species are gross. They're just different.
That's true, but the collection is nothing if not a tiny bit judgmental. So
now you are a publicist, and now you are actually the author of this collection of your essays, and you're probably working with a publicist.
I am working with a publicist. It's weird to sit in this chair and not outside in the green room looking in.
So there's an opportunity to be judgmental.
Against my publicist?
Yes.
She is such a saint, I have to say. Her name is Melissa Broder. She's lovely.
I've talked to so many authors who either, and they never say it on the air, but then, afterwards, sometimes the conversation turns to either how much they love or how much they hate their publicist.
Well, I think it's a very difficult job. You're the last stop on a very long train. And if anything has not worked out up until that point, you don't like your cover, you're worried about the material itself, you're a little insecure about it, you're worried about the amount of money or time that's being poured into it, the last sort of thing you can lean on is your publicist. So it's very difficult.
You were quoted in the recent New York Times article, "It's not you, it's your books." And you said, if you're a person who loves Alice Munro and you're going out with someone whose favorite book is The Da Vinci Code, perhaps the flags of incompatibility were there. prior to the big reveal. Have you ever broken up with someone based on what you saw on their bookshelves?
No, certainly not. I have not done that. I have, if they don't have bookshelves, that seems to be a larger problem. You know, if there's just no interest in reading whatsoever, there's no interest in sort of entering a world like that.
It's just issues of Maxim and Playboy on the coffee
just
table.
Issues. Well, as long as they're the ones I wrote for, I mean, that's flattering.
Then it's okay. Yes. Oh, a guy named Bob just called in off the air to say, actually, that Atlas moth is very beautiful.
It's fuzzy. I think it's the fuzzy factor. You know, it's named an Atlas moth because it actually looks like a map of the world, which doesn't that sound pretty? You can see through parts of its wings, though.
You know, people just have different tastes. I mean, how many times have you seen, like, a person you think is really ugly and they're married? And you think, like, how did that person ever find a spouse?
And what is wrong with me? I don't understand.
The New York Observer profile of you said you suffered from a spatial dysphagia disorder. Is that a serious thing?
No, not at all. In fact, that's actually, and it's not the reporter's fault. He just, it was transcribed incorrectly. I don't think that exists. It's basically just a spatial disability where I can't tell time. I can't.
We have a minute left.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I have no concept of what that means. I can't. When I look at an analog clock, I have difficulty with it. I have just, you know, odd spatial problems. That's all.
So you're a digital world girl.
I'm a digital world girl. Unfortunately, they don't make many sleek digital clocks, but I managed to survive. That's another source of disappointment, not being able to tell time.
What's the worst? We have 30 seconds, so why don't you tell us what the worst thing about being a publicist in New York City was?
Oh my gosh. Authors not realizing that you're not going to get fired if you do a bad job on their book, and
ooh,
they should be a little bit nicer.
Uh-huh. Very good. Yeah. And you have, it's like, come on, you know, you think your book is so important, but I have 15 clients right now,
right,
who all think that.
Exactly. Well, your job is allegedly to make them feel like they're the only one.
So now you too can read Sloane Crosley's essays like The Pony Problem, Christmas in July. Oh, I wish we had time to get to that one, where your Jewish parents sent you to a Christian camp. But people will just have to read those for themselves in your new book of essays called I Was Told There'd Be Cake. And you're doing a reading tonight at 7 p.m. at the Tribeca Barnes & Noble. That's at 97 Warren Street, right?
Yes. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for coming in. It was fun. Brian Lehrer on WNYC.